All right, so John, the other day we were talking about equipment, and you mentioned that when you started, you were looking around at a whole bunch of equipment, and you eventually settled upon, I guess, things that work for you. So one thing that I wanted to ask you was, because I kind of suck at landscape photography, is if you had to, like, just boil down your equipment to the very basics, and let's say you were going on a trip someplace, you go, like, Patagonia or climbing some mountain someplace, and you could only take really basic stuff, you know, one body, one lens, whatever you need, what would that be and why?
Well, you're shooting a Canon 5D Mark II, aren't you?
Yeah, all Canon stuff, but yeah, that's the main one.
Yeah, I mean, I was shooting a Pentax medium format film camera for like the first 8 years that I was taking landscape photos. And, you know, I pretty much switched over all my landscape and wildlife photography to shooting digital like 2.5-3 years ago now. And especially once that Canon 5D Mark II came out, I mean, that thing is just amazing. The pictures you can take with that compared to what I was dragging around those big medium format film cameras. You know, big difference. So, you know, for somebody like yourself who's already, you know, got one of these cameras that you're doing the underwater photography with, it, you know, you're not having to make an investment in any new equipment. And then are you using like the Canon 16-35 or 17-40 lens?
Yeah, I've got 17-40. I could never justify paying more for the 16-35.
Absolutely. You know, the 16-35 is like, what, twice as expensive, but
it's like
honestly,
$1,000 more.
Honestly, like, you're not getting like $1,000 better picture out of it. So,
yeah, that's what I always thought.
And then specifically, like, for me with landscape photography, I'm always shooting my landscape photos on a tripod, so I'm stopping the lens down to like f16, f22.
Right.
And everything I've always read about the Canon, the two Canon wide angle zooms, they perform the same at stop down at f16. So unless you really need f2.8 instead of f4 for low light shooting, it's really not, I don't think, worth the investment. But, you know, I've kind of been after even that more perfect image, like everybody always is. And I've been intrigued by the Carl Zeiss started making some lenses specifically for the Canon and Nikon mounts. And I contacted Zeiss USA a couple years ago, and I told them I was interested in maybe testing, demoing their a couple of their fixed prime manual focus lenses that I have. So if you don't need autofocus and you, you know, do a lot of hyperfocal focusing for big depth of field pictures like I do, these Zeiss lenses are great for it. But again, like, a big expense, you know, each one of these lenses is anywhere from $700 to up to like $1,800 for one focal length.
So what's the one that you, what's your standby, the one that you use the most?
So I've started out shooting that 17-40, and that's still a great lens, and I do a lot of shooting with that still. But I find myself shooting landscapes mostly in the 28mm to 35mm range, as opposed to like super wide 17 and 20mm.
Okay, is there a reason besides aesthetics?
Yeah, well, mainly it's the aesthetics. I've just always found that for landscape photography, I kind of like the balance between a really wide foreground and like the mountains or the beach or something in the distance kind of being balanced, rather than that really exaggerated look that happens when you'd go really wide.
Right, right.
And, you know, so the wider you get, that's really not like the compositions that I look for. I often tell people, I can tell right away if somebody just took a wide angle zoom and set it on the widest setting and then set their tripod up at like a full height, you know, like eye level, as opposed to getting down closer to the ground and into your subject. So, you know, anyways, these Zeiss lenses are worth the investment if you're after that last critical extra little sharpness, you know, that the Canon zoom's not giving you, and it's mainly happening more at the corners. Like, everybody's always worried about the corners.
So you can see the difference?
I can see the difference. So the question I always have to people is, like, do you need to go spend another $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 on a couple of focal lengths specific, you know, for your landscape photography? And for me, you know, I've got some sponsorship, so I got a little bit better of a deal on purchasing these lenses, and they are better, but you know, it's like, are they 20% better or 30% better? No, you know, they're better, but they're not like this huge noticeable improvement that anybody taking pictures with a 17 to 40 lens is going to never publish their images because they don't own these Zeiss lenses.
Right. Got it. Okay. So back to the original question, what would be the one choice if you only had one?
Well, so if I was only going to do one thing before I bought those Zeiss lenses, it was carrying around my Canon 5D Mark II with the 17 to 40 F4 lens.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. I mean,
that covers a great amount of area for, you know, great range for shooting landscapes. And, you know, it's lightweight. It can go into one of those like basic top load, like low pro bags, and fits real easy in a backpack or in your, you know, whether you're going multi-day camping or just afternoon hiking.
Yeah.
So real simple setup.
Well, that's good to hear, because that's within everybody's reach, budget.
Absolutely.
Easily available, and lots of people know how to use that equipment too. So,
you know, and I don't find myself often shooting like telephoto landscape images. It's just kind of not my thing as much. I do it, but like, it's just not stuff that I really sell or like find myself drawn to as much.
Right.
One of the other problems is I own the Canon 70 to 200 f/2.8 IS lens.
Yeah.
And backpacking with that thing for as little as I use it is a pain in my butt.
Yeah.
So the one thing I advise, like a lot of people when I'm giving presentations and workshops, is if you're going to backpack with something in that focal range, the Canon 70 to 200 f/4 lens does the same thing, and it's like half the weight and half the size, and you know, a third less expensive. So
So basically what I'm hearing from you is that you're trying to optimize for not just the fact that you need to take great photos, but that you gotta schlep all this stuff around with you.
Absolutely. You know, I think that you know, whether I'm going backpacking for, you know, setting up a base camp 10, 15 miles or so in some place and then doing multi-day hikes and stuff from there, or even just going out for the afternoon, but I'm walking 6 or 8, 10 miles, you know, I'm stripping my equipment down to like the minimal amount that I think that I'm going to need for that shoot.
Yeah.
And certainly if I've been to a place before and I've gotten skunked the first time and I know exactly which lens I need when I go back there, you know, that makes my choice of equipment even easier. So
yeah, of course, having the experience in a location, that's true for every type of photography.
You know, I started carrying around the two Zeiss lenses that I use most often, which is the Carl Zeiss 28 millimeter f/2 lens and the 35 millimeter f/2 lens. So now, like this recent trip that I went to Patagonia in January, it was the 17 to 40 and the two Zeiss lenses. And those things are, you know, they're all solid glass, so they're pretty heavy for as small as they are. So
Right. So what else? I mean, okay, so you've got the say that handful of lenses and camera bodies. What else? What else do you take with you? I mean, you know, I assume you use a lot of equipment for stabilization, right?
Well, yeah. So I've got a tripod, and I have two tripods, and you know, the one is more beat up than the other, but my smaller one is the one that I take backpacking, and it's a Gitzo like GT1541, I think is the number on it. It's one of their smaller ones, and you know, I started using it a little bit more often than just backpacking because my other one's kind of so beat up now. But you know, I mean I stand in the middle of like the ocean with my tripod, and as you can imagine, everything starts falling apart as soon as you do that. And then I use the Acritech Ultimate ball head. It's kind of one of the lighter ball heads that you can get.
Yeah, so you like that one.
I do. And, you know, but I don't have any sponsorship or anything with those guys. I just bought it years ago. And, you know, again, my stuff's all pretty beat up at this point with all the outdoor activities I do to it. But it still works. It's never been repaired or anything. So,
yeah.
But, you know, another thing that I really like is I have an L bracket. I don't know if anybody knows the L brackets, somehow I went for like the first 8 years with that medium format camera without an L bracket, and I'd flop my camera over on a side to shoot a vertical.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I did that, but now that I use the L brackets, it's just, you could never take that away from me.
So wait, just explain that really quickly. What does that do?
Yeah, so the L bracket is, instead of just having the quick release plate on the bottom of the camera,
mm-hmm.
and then if you want to take a vertical composition while it's on the tripod, you usually have to flip the ball head over on its side,
mm-hmm.
and then it gets the weight off to the side, and it's kind of a mess to get like critically in focus, or not in focus, but balanced.
Yeah.
With the L bracket, you can just take the camera, and it's got like an L that comes out to the bottom side of it, and then there's another quick release part on the side. So you can take the camera out of the quick release plate and just flip it vertically and reattach it without having to flip the ball head over on its side.
Cool.
So they're pretty handy. They're not cheap either. I think most of the companies are like $150, $180 to buy one of these things. But
yeah. Do you know what brand do you use?
I use the Kirk L brackets.
Right.
So that's why I think I use Kirk on most of my stuff.
Right.
And then, you know, certainly the other really, really critical component of my equipment that I have to drag around everywhere is I use these Singray graduated neutral density filters to control the contrast range in these wide angle landscape exposures.
Right.
And, you know, I also use a polarizer a little bit. So I have four filters that I always advise people to purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, you know, like I said, I've been working with Singray since I started out, and then I've gotten sponsored with them the last few years, just in the interest of full disclosure here. But mm-hmm. they make great products, and the Singray Lighter Brighter Warming Polarizer
uh-huh.
is I buy that in the thin mount version so that I can attach it to my really wide angle 17-40 and not have any vignetting issues.
Right, thin mount. This is a screw on.
It's a screw-on polarizer in the thin mount version. And the thin mount, what it's missing is it doesn't have an outer set of threads to be able to attach like another filter in front of it.
Right. That's why it's thinner.
That's why it's thinner. And what ends up vignetting when you put like a regular polarizer on a really wide-angle lens is actually that the ring, the part of the polarizer that sticks out in front of the where the threads are at.
Yeah, that's why you see those ugly dark corners in some people's photos.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I hate that look. So, you know, but there's a couple other challenges that happen with having to attach the grad filters. I use the Kokin size P mount holder and the Kokin P size filters from Singray.
Yeah.
And the three filters that I recommend everybody, in addition to that polarizer, is a two stop hard, a three stop hard, and a three-stop soft edge graduated neutral density filter.
Right.
And those four filters cover like 99% of everything I ever shoot.
Okay, well, I could ask you about those, but it would probably extend this conversation for a long
time. Yeah, that's okay. But, you know, going back to just like how I attach those things, you know, maybe that is another whole conversation. But if I have the polarizer on there without the threads to thread one of these Kokin rings on the front.
Uh-huh.
I've actually taken the Kokin holder and just kind of taken a razor blade on the inside of it.
Uh-huh.
And then this thing slides over my thin mount polarizer, and then I can slide the grad filter on.
Right, right. So you don't get that vignetting.
So I don't have any vignetting. So on my 17-40, I can put the thin mount polarizer and a Kokin holder with the grad filter attached and not get any vignetting at 17 millimeters. So.
Right. Oh, cool. So
yeah, it works pretty well. So
yeah. So how much? Wait. So you've got, let's see if I remember correctly. You got a camera. You've got 1-3 lenses. You got a bunch of filters, a tripod.
A tripod.
A
really
ball head. That Aquatech yep. ball head.
Yep.
Do you use a cable release? I assume you do, right?
You know, I used to use a cable release, uh-huh. but now I use this little Canon infrared remote.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like $19. You put it in 2-second mode, and then you can just use that with...
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and then the one thing that a lot of people miss out on, and I've had people show up on my workshops, even though I've told them to buy one of these beforehand,
mm-hmm.
is you have to have one of those little... spirit levels, like a ball level,
yeah,
a bubble level,
uh-huh.
and they're kind of expensive for what they are, like usually $30-$40, and it goes in the hot shoe on the top of your camera,
uh-huh.
And that thing, you know, that way you can keep the horizons level in all your photos.
Right, but wait, because sometimes the ground isn't mm-hmm. level, so if your spirit level shows level, you're not actually level in the photo, right? How do you deal
say
with
that again?
Well, like if the horizon isn't necessarily level for some reason.
No, the horizon's always going to be level.
It's always going to be level.
Yeah, the horizon's always going to be level, and if anything, if the ground or the beach or the mountain or whatever is slightly to an angle, that's fine. You know, you just got to incorporate that into the picture. So.
Okay, well, that's why I'm not a landscape photographer.
Yeah.
I just realized I asked a really stupid question.
Yeah, sorry. No, I mean, I'm trying to think about, like, underwater if I'm, like, looking up.
No, no, because underwater, not everything doesn't, even though it may appear level, it's not level. I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. Totally different frame of reference. Yeah. So there's just one other thing that you mentioned that hyperfocal, the term hyperfocal. Yep. Can you explain that a little bit?
Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
I am, but you know I rarely ever use that concept underwater.
Yeah, I mean you can't. It's the optics, well, and even the hyperfocal scale underwater is not going to be the same for the optics of the lens. So.
Yeah. Well, you can kind of, but it's not going to be the same.
So what I end up doing, and this is always a hard concept when I'm teaching it, so I'll try to whittle it down, but since I'm on a tripod and my subject, I'm often trying to shoot from like 3 feet to infinity and just have everything in focus. Mm-hmm. I can accomplish that by stopping the lens down to f/16. Mm-hmm. And when I was using these medium format prime lenses for all these years, they all had their manual focus, and they all have a hyperfocal scale on it, which if you look at it, it's these tick marks that are on the focus part of the lens that shows, like, it starts on one side from, like, f22, f16, f11, f8 to whatever, and then it goes back up, increments back up to f11, f16, f22. Mm-hmm. And what you can do is you take the infinity mark on the lens and you rotate it so that the infinity mark lines up with f16 on one side. Mm-hmm. And then there's the scale that then starts incrementing down, and maybe the next part is like 10 feet and then 6 feet and then 3 feet and 2 feet, 1 feet. Mm-hmm. And so when you move the infinity mark over to say f/16 on the right side of my Zeiss lens, you also gain the f/16 on the left side. And so that f/16 on the left side of the focus point might be 2 feet or 3 feet. And so it becomes very easy for me to focus, but all I'm not concerned at all about what I'm focusing on. Mm-hmm. All I'm concerned about is that I have the infinity mark on f/16 and that I get everything from 3 feet to infinity and focus at the same time.
So you pretty much know, like, if I'm using this lens and I'm at f/16, I'm going to be focused from infinity
to
3 feet.
That's it. That's right. That's all the thought that has to go into and all the technique that goes into focusing. Now, I see a lot of people get bogged down in trying to figure out, like, you can go online and look at these depth of field calculators or have the iPhone app, and it'll tell you, okay, if you want f/18 and you want to be able to focus from, you know, 2 feet to infinity at this focal length, you need to focus on 6.192 feet.
Right.
But it's like, who cares? It's like, all you want to do is have from 2 feet to infinity in focus, and you just need to know what that wedge is that's going to be in focus at the same time.
Right, right. Well, yeah. Well, you put a lot of iPhone apps out of business if everyone knew that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, these numbers. So, you know, most of the pictures I take, it's like I just get within 2 or 3, 4 feet of my subject, mm-hmm. get down low enough to the ground that I'm within that range. And then I move that infinity mark to f/16 on the barrel. Mm-hmm. And then I know from 3 feet to infinity is going to be in focus. And that's all the amount of effort I put into focusing.
Right.
I want to spend the rest of the time actually on composition and lighting and, you know, all the other technical things that I should be doing.
Right. Cool.
Rather than getting bogged down in, like, focusing or, you know, the bubble level there is to, like, the horizon should be level. Like, that's all there is to it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be kind of interesting to try to use a bubble level underwater.
Yeah. Like, I can think of, like, when I was in Indonesia last month, like, you know, I'm, like, angled up, looking straight up at the surface to take pictures, and, like, you know, what's a bubble level? What's the point of that?
So. Yeah. Actually, the thing that helps underwater is to have one of those grid screens on your, if you're assuming you're using an SLR,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So that you've got those the grid lines overlaid, so you can kind of at least judge not level per se, but orientation.
Uh-huh.
So I found that helps quite a bit. And those screens are, they're not very expensive. I mean, they're, I forget, maybe $30 or $40 or something.
Yeah, sure. They just pop right out when you like open the
Take
cap off there.
Yeah, basically. So that does help. I mean, in the instances where you are looking at a line, like say sand across the bottom or something like that, at least you can line up against one of those grid lines and see that you're, you know, it helps. Even if you're a couple of degrees off, it kind of looks tilted.
Actually, as I start to transition into asking you a couple of questions here, just out of curiosity then, are you bumping into like that kind of horizon very often? And then if so, like in my Ica light housing, I don't have any, what do they call those things? The attachments to like magnify the view on the back of the
viewfinders. Yeah.
Viewfinder. Do you use one of those?
I don't.
Because I wouldn't be able to see my grid lines in my camera looking through it.
I was curious. So. Well, I think I'm kind of fortunate because I'm nearsighted. And when you go underwater, that actually helps. Mm-hmm. So my vision underwater is actually clearer than it is on land. So, you know, the little, I have a very little viewfinder, just a normal one on the back.
Yeah.
And I'm able to see everything very clearly. In fact, down to critical focus, like for macro stuff. So I don't know how much longer that'll last for me, but but so far I haven't had to use them, and I don't use them not because they're not good. I've tried them on a few housings, but they add a lot of weight and bulk. So I know a lot of my friends swear by them, but for me right now, just the it's kind of everything is a trade-off, right? So to be able to carry or to need to carry that much more weight. Plus, I usually have like a minimum of 3 housings with me. So to have that, if each viewfinder is say like 1 kilo, that's another 3 kilos of weight, not to mention the space to take up in luggage. So for the time being, I don't use those. And a lot of the stuff I do, like with the big stuff, you know, if you're swimming with cetaceans or, you know, basically out in the open ocean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you're basically relying on reaction time.
Yes.
So the lighter I am, the faster I can go, and the quicker I can react, and the quicker I can change the orientation of the camera. That's a lot more important to me than being able to frame exactly right. Because when you're out in the blue, if you get something just a couple degrees off, you can always move that around in post, you know.
But, yeah.
But if you're in those times when I'm on reefs, like I'm headed to Papua New Guinea soon, where there's a lot of reef stuff. Then basically it's just I compensate for not having a viewfinder by just spending more time, you know, just sitting there a little bit longer trying to get that exact framing correct, checking all the corners, checking the sides, you know, spending a lot of time setting up the photo before actually pulling the trigger.
Well, you know, that's interesting because, you know, I was kind of having a hard time when I was in Indonesia in March, and I was kind of just going for I'm going to shoot enough pictures here of this picture as I'm floating in and out of it, hoping that one of them was going to have the right framing. So I certainly don't claim to have my technique down underwater as much as you, but
I wouldn't even try to claim on landscapes, so.
All right, well, you know, I was asking you the other day about my my dome port on my Ica light housing.
Yeah.
And you know, it's an acrylic 8-inch dome, and I, you know, certainly a lot of people I've seen online kind of start slagging it, and I don't really want to get involved in that. But, you know, I publish images using that housing and that equipment, and I was just curious, you know, what kind of dome port you were using with your system.
Yeah. Well, my general view on equipment, housings, ports, all that stuff is basically just to use what works. There's a lot of discussion, I think, online, especially the past few years, because there's so much, it's so much easier to talk with people on online forums and stuff now. And people get, I think, overly concerned with the hardware and which kind of detracts from actually taking the photos. So there needs to be a minimum quality. You know, you can't use a complete piece of crap, basically. And there are some things that are complete pieces of crap. But if you have a certain minimum level of quality in the hardware, the rest is really up to you as a photographer and to technique and to circumstance and luck, of course. So, you know, the domes I have are made in Japan, and they're called Pro One domes. And actually a friend of mine designed and built them. The guy who designed the Nikon RS lenses designed these domes as a response to my complaining for many years earlier that there were no good domes in Japan, and there weren't for many years. They were they were pretty bad because underwater photography in Japan tended to concentrate on macro stuff or using the Nikonos cameras, which had great lenses. You know, the old 15 mil for the Nikonos 5 and the 13 mil fisheye for the RS-13. They were the best lenses ever made for underwater.
When's the last time you saw somebody actually dive with a Nikonos?
People still do in Japan.
Do they?
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of people still shoot film.
Yeah.
So it's been slow to change. Things have been changing in the past, say, 3 years here in Japan, but Japan was probably in general 3 to 4 years behind everybody else switching to digital.
Hmm.
So kind of paradoxical given that all the technologies from here
was developed there, sure.
Yeah, but the usage adoption has been slower to start. It's really changing quickly now, but you still see people using the film cameras. But anyway, starting with those lenses, I mean, basically when people were shooting wide-angle stuff in Japan, that's what they were using, and they were the best. There was no need to use anything else. So most of the domes here were not that great. And, you know, friends of mine overseas were using, you know, some pretty terrific domes from all of the manufacturers, which kind of maybe have dome envy to some extent.
Yeah.
And, you know, this guy developed these domes. They're fantastic. They're 7 inches, really excellent glass, and they produce terrific results. People ask me a lot about the domes when they see them on trips and stuff, and I have no problem recommending them. But then, you know, when somebody asks, should I throw away my other dome and get this dome? You know, that's when it starts to become, you know, not so important. Because when somebody has a dome that's made, say, by any of the manufacturers that people know about, Eyeglite, Subald, Seacam, Quatica, you know, all of them, they're all good. So I don't, unless you have a special purpose, like, for example, if you have a really, really big dome, it's easier to take half and half shots because you have a bigger surface area for the water to split. You know, then I could see somebody saying, okay, I need a bigger dome for that. Or if you are, you know, really burdened down with luggage and you just don't really want to have a lot of weight and you want to use one of the new small domes that have become fashionable recently, which in any case are not a new idea. They've been around for a long time. But, you know, then okay. But if you have a dome and you're using it and you're getting good results like you are with your Eyeglite, I don't see any reason to, like, specifically go out and change or adopt one of the new domes that has become fashionable or anything like that.
Well, the interesting thing is, like, I kind of look at it as, yeah, I can see where my Eyeglite taken, you know, pictures fall off at, like, the 70, 80, 90% range as you go outwards.
Yeah.
But I can say that same thing about that 17 to 40 lens when I'm shooting just a landscape with the same lens above water.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I can tell you that, like, yeah, you can spend all this extra money on these Zeiss lenses to get another, you know, get to 90% to the edge of the frame sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
So, diminishing returns.
Yeah, and also knowing the limitations of your hardware, or not limitations, but the operating characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you said with domes, all domes are going to have some sort of fall off. You know, some are going to be better than others. I mean, there's no question, like, the optical glass used in my dome is some of the best in the world. So it has to be better than something that's, say, acrylic. But how much better? It's like the same thing you were talking about, the 1740 lens versus your Zeiss lenses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no question it's, you know, that one's going to be better, but does it really matter? I mean, a lot of the photos that I've taken that have been published or put on display have been taken with, you know, for example, using a 1740 lens as opposed to a 1635, or using a less high quality dome before I had these good domes, for example. But knowing how your equipment operates is what's important. Like, if I know that my 1740 lens is not going to operate well at f4, then I just avoid as much as possible shooting at f4.
Sure.
You know, it's the same thing. And underwater, you can get away with that, especially now with the DSLRs with the ISO performance so much better now. You know, you can hike up. I think a lot of people forget you can hike up the ISO a little bit. And increase or use a smaller aperture as a result,
mm-hmm.
which really helps on a lens like a 1740. So I think the bottom line is, if you know your hardware and you operate within the operating characteristics or the optimal usage conditions for the hardware, you can compensate for a lot of the issues that you might have. Like my dome, as I mentioned, is 7 inches. It's certainly not going to be as easy taking half shots as with like a 9-inch dome or a 10-inch dome.
Okay.
But I do it, and I got some great shots, and it's a lot lighter and a lot smaller than carrying around a 10-inch dome. So, you know, there's trade-offs with everything, and that's what the most important thing to keep in mind, well, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that most people probably maybe don't necessarily understand with the, like, amount of time that you and I are out is, like, you know, it really doesn't matter what equipment we got. It's like we're taking advantage of situations and opportunities, and like you said, we have reasonable amount of equipment. I don't have to have the best theoretical piece of equipment to take that picture. It only matters if I'm the only person that took that.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you know, I don't know about you, but I have a lot of times when I go on trips and I have equipment failure. Like I went to Ambon last year and 2 out of 3 housings that I just got in service failed on me. So I had to work around that, which is very frustrating. People were there and saw it.
Yeah.
I remember how ticked off I was, but you know, I came back and I had a lot of good stuff because you just got to work around it. And so I think more important than, say, paying another $1,000 or $5,000 or whatever to get more equipment is to really know the equipment that you have,
mm-hmm.
and really be able to milk it for every, you know, every penny that you put into it. That's probably, and I'll give you another example. It's like, somebody wrote to the guy who, made these domes recently, past a couple months or so, mm-hmm. and kind of took him to task because he said that the this guy had apparently done the numbers and worked out that this dome was physically impossible to use with a 1017 Tokina lens. Like, the physical characteristics wouldn't work, and he was, you know, he was criticizing the guy for, like, saying that it would work. So, you know, I don't know. I don't sit there and calculate the numbers, and I don't worry about it. I just stick the lens in and see if it works.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I've been using this 1017 lens with this camera, with this dome, since the guy made the domes. And I've produced lots of photos that have been published and lots of photos that will be published with mm-hmm. it, because it works beautifully with a dome. So
and you're using this 10-17 on the 7D?
Well, since back with the, I think the first camera was a 40D. But yeah, okay. Since then, yeah, now on the 7D, and it works beautifully. I mean, the lens has certain limitations, but certainly with this dome, I mean, I guess the point was that with this dome, this hardware that I already have, it works just fine. But, you know, there was somebody who was writing in and saying, you know, he's done the numbers, done the calculations, it's physically impossible, you shouldn't be advertising this. It's just weird. I mean, people get too obsessed with... Well, I think with trends, especially recently, because you see it on forums and discussion groups a lot, and people get, you know, there's a lot of hype about certain things that hardware, particularly that come out, and then everybody wants one, and then suddenly it's the best thing that's ever happened. And certainly there's been a couple trends with domes just in the past few years, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It was the bigger the dome you had, the better, and recently it's been the smaller the dome you have, the better.
That's funny.
It's really,
yeah,
just ludicrous. But I guess the short answer is, if you're using an IKE Lite system, you're happy with the dome and it's working, then just stick with it.
Well, I think that's my plan, because trying to spend, you know, for going from a $500 dome to a $2,500 dome, that's a pretty big expense for me. So
yeah,
not to mention that I'd have to buy a different housing, because none of these other domes are compatible with the IKE Lite housing either. So
yeah, well, that's a good point too. A lot of the equipment isn't necessarily cross compatible. There are mm-hmm. some adapters made and stuff like that, which work well sometimes.
Do you know of anybody that makes an adapter for any of these more expensive domes for IKE Lite?
I don't offhand. I haven't really looked into it though.
Yeah,
there could be. I don't. If I need something, then I'll look into it. But usually, I don't just go and look.
Sure.
So.
Well, you know, we've been talking for a little while here, so
yeah.
Maybe people are getting tired of listening to us, but...
I don't know.
No.
Maybe. So where are you? You're heading out pretty soon, right?
Yeah, I leave actually today is Tuesday, so I'm leaving Thursday morning to head up to Anchorage, and that'll be my first trip of the year up to Alaska. So,
what are you doing up there?
I am starting the trip. I have a small boat that I keep up in Alaska, and so that's allowed me a lot of these really unique photo opportunities. And one of the reasons that I can get up there as much is I've got my costs and my transportation, my lodging all taken care of once I fly up and use my boat.
Right.
So knowing that, I scheduled a couple of presentations and some workshops at Anchorage and Fairbanks this weekend. So this will be the first time that I'm working with the Anchorage REI, and then I'm also working with the Fairbanks Smug Mug Group. And so that'll be the next few days. And then I fly back from Fairbanks to Anchorage on Monday night. And then next Tuesday, I am going to catch the ferry across Prince William Sound from Whittier over to Cordova and photograph the Copper River shorebird migration. They get a couple million shorebirds that congregate on the mudflats where the Copper River comes out of the mountains there. And they use the Copper River to fly up into interior Alaska and then up into the Arctic to have their young during the summer to nest.
Cool.
So I'm going to spend about 5 days there. And then from there, I'm going to go back across on the ferry, back to Whittier, back to Anchorage. I have a friend that trades or loans me his car or his truck, and I'm going to borrow his truck, pick up my boat that's getting de-winterized in Anchorage, drive that back to Whittier, and then I'm going to go out on my first cruise for a week and go visit some glaciers and hopefully photograph some icebergs and harbor seals and sea otters for about a week.
Very cool.
So a lot of topside stuff. No underwater this trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
Yeah. Should be pretty interesting. So hopefully the weather will cooperate. I've always heard the weather can be kind of nice in May in Alaska, so we're about to find out.
So. Oh, so you've never been up there in May?
You know, I've been up there one time in late April, early May, and that week part of it was actually really nice, and then it went back to being like the usual kind of pathetic rain and overcast. So I've just kind of adapted to what the kind of standards are for what I need to shoot up there in those kind of conditions.
Right.
Like icebergs are great in cloudy, overcast weather. You don't want to photograph an iceberg when it's like sunny out. So,
right.
But, you know, when you have that opportunity versus like walking around barefoot in Indonesia at a dive resort, you know, it's two different realities. So,
yeah. Well, I prefer the warm weather.
Yeah. You've told me that. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, I'm headed to, over to Papua New Guinea soon. Going to be spending almost five weeks on, Liverboard Golden Dawn, which I've been on quite a bit with Captain Craig, is a really good friend. And so this trip is kind of exciting because we start in Port Moresby and we're going to be cruising around the Papua New Guinea Peninsula, where there's a barrier reef system, which really, I mean, I don't think anybody dives it. I know people have dived it before, but nobody really dives it regularly. So there's some... both Craig and Bob Halstead, who's, you know, was one of the guys who started diving in Papua New Guinea, have told me tremendous things about the barrier reef. So it's going to be the first time I have to go and explore that. And the great thing is that I asked Bob to come along, so Bob's going to be on the trip too, which is great. He knows so much about the diving in Papua New Guinea, and he's a great guy, really funny, very well-educated, great guy to talk to. So, and you know, I'm looking forward to learning a lot from him. So we're going to cruise around the tip of the peninsula, go up the coast over to, Milne Bay, which, is a fantastic place. And it's really amazing because, you know, the kind of everything is dominated by trends, but back in, I guess the 70s and 80s, Milne Bay was like the place to go.
Kind of like Raja Ampat is now.
Yeah, it was really up there, and everybody wanted to go there, and for good reason. And there were, you know, four or five boats there and resort there and everything. And then starting, I guess, maybe late 80s, early 90s, Papua New Guinea kind of started to fade from the limelight, partially because I think because other places started to open up, say Indonesia. And there's just not many people that go diving there now. There's some, but not many. And I did a TV program there a few years ago with NHK in Japan. There's amazing stuff. I've been there a few times. But the best part is going to be that we're going to have all this great stuff in Milne Bay, which is at the crossroads of three different currents. So there's upwelling, there's cold water, warm water, there's big stuff, mantas, there's tiny stuff, there's dugongs, all sorts of things. And there's going to be nobody else there.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then we're going to go from there and cruise up all the way up to Walindi, which is another great place, and dive the reefs along the way. Again, not too many people get to visit those areas out in the open ocean. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to spend a few days over at Walindi, where definitely we'll be diving. But one of the things I'm looking forward to is this, there are some trees right outside the resort, a couple minutes away by car, where at night the lightning bugs gather, fireflies.
Yeah.
And they gather by the, I don't know, tens or hundreds of thousands. Huh. And they flash in synchronicity. So they're all going at the same time. And it's like this big pulsing light show.
Really?
It's totally amazing. The last time I saw it, I mean, I haven't been there in a few years, but the last time I think I was there was maybe 2004 or 5 or something like that. And it was just mind-blowing. And at that time, I had film.
Yeah.
So it wasn't possible to capture it. So I'm hoping that now with the digital technologies...
Do we need to take a break here and describe film to people?
No.
No? Okay.
No, I don't think so. I don't even think I have anymore. I still use the film canisters to store stuff, though.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that now with the new, with the SLRs, we'll be able to pick that up. And I'm not sure about photos, but maybe in video. I don't know. But it's pretty amazing because you go out there and it's pitch black. And you see this pulsing light show. And the fireflies in a certain section will all be pulsing together. And maybe a little farther away, they'll be pulsing in a different rhythm. But if you shine a light on them, like turn on your headlights or just take a flashlight and you know, shine lights on them, it messes them up. So they lose their synchronous pulsing. And then you turn off the light and you see the little... Basically, I think what happens is the fireflies look at the fireflies next to them and they start pulsing together in little patches. So
they're trying to get back into like a harmonic frequency. With
exactly. These. And they do it in little patches, and then the patches start to sync together, and then the bigger patches sync together, and then pretty soon they're all back in sync.
Wow.
It's an amazing sight. I mean, it's one of those things that you just, I mean, I can't do it justice just by describing it. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to, you know, capture that on video or something just so we can just share it.
That's interesting that you were kind of finishing off like talking about that, because like obviously so many of our experiences that we're fortunate enough to have, like we don't actually have pictures to show anybody.
Oh, exactly. I mean, there's so many things I've seen that all I can do is describe, but you know, you can never really fully appreciate what someone's seen.
Yes.
So yeah, that's one of those things I've really been wanting to get back and see, and I hope that it's... Well, I hope it's still as amazing as it was when I saw it before.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, in case anybody's listening, I guess we should wrap up by just mentioning this kind of exciting project that we're kicking off.
Definitely.
So, I guess the basic idea is that you've been going up to Alaska for the past, was it 5 years or so?
Well, Southeast Alaska for 5 years, but in Alaska almost 8 years now.
Yeah. And the humpbacks there, you've got some amazing photos of the bubble netting and the breaching and that kind of behavior up there.
Yeah.
And
honestly, that's one of the reasons I bought that boat, was specifically to go do that.
Yeah, well, it worked.
Yeah, it did. But I don't think everybody else is going to go buy a boat just to do that. So.
No. So, and I've been going down to Tonga for like the past 10 years to photograph... mostly in the water, but a lot of breaching stuff too. But you know, the behavior is different. You get the calving and the competition for mates in the heat run activity, the sort of just hanging out, the boys hanging out together, singing, all that kind of stuff. So the basic idea is that we're gonna do a combined trip in August. It's August 2012, right? Next year.
Yeah. July, end of July, and into end of August.
Right.
Of 2012.
Okay, so what we're looking at is taking 6 people, because it's sort of an optimal size in both locations, to Alaska to see basically the feeding behavior,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, the bubble netting and the breaching, and then spending about 10 days there. Is that right?
Yep. that's what we're looking at. About 10 days, we're going to use about a 54-foot yacht, and then we're going to have two inflatables, which Tony and I will be able to motor, so there'll only be three guests in each boat with us, so four people in each boat. Mm-hmm. And we'll go to the places where I know that the whales are hanging out. And, you know, anybody who's ever done whale photography, or if you haven't, like, knows that it definitely involves a lot of, like, just being there. You can never predict what's going to happen, but by spending enough days in the same locations, hopefully we'll see some breaching. And, you know, we'll definitely go to the spots where I know they typically bubble feed in July and August. And, you know, so that they're up there, they're doing it at that time of year. It's just like, we've got to go find them for a couple of days. And then once we do, we'll use those inflatables to go out and get as close as possible. And, you know, it's pretty amazing, some of these areas, being out there, and especially if it's a nice day, which is really unusual in Southeast Alaska. But, you know, I've been out there at 11 o'clock at night as the sun was setting, and had, you know, whales all around me, and I've been in my inflatable all by myself, and nobody else is around, and just me and like a dozen whales. It's just incredible, you know?
So basically you're guaranteeing that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
But what I can guarantee is in 10 days where we're going to, that you're going to see some whales. I can't guarantee the photos, but we will see whales. So,
right. And then we'll take a quick break, basically.
Yeah, I think we're looking at about 2 week break.
Yeah, approximately 2 week break, and then reconvening in Tonga with the same six people, where I'll take you to basically go see them doing their thing, with competing with one another, boys competing with one another for female attention, seeing the some newborn humpback whales, mm-hmm. moms and calves together, and try to find singers for you, and get the beauty of all this is not just seeing them, but getting in the water and seeing them in the water. And having some pretty close encounters sometimes, which is really quite amazing. I mean, I've taken hundreds of people there, and it never fails to move you. People come out, you know, the first time somebody gets in with a whale, it's quite an experience.
Indeed it is.
So, anyway, John and I will be posting more details on our respective blogs, which is, what's your blog URL?
My blog URL is cornforthimagesblog.com.
cornforthimagesblog.com.
Yep.
And mine is tonywublog, tonywublog.com, all one word. So we'll be posting more details about the trip, and in the meantime, if you're listening, if you have interest, contact either one of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I filled out I set up a page on my main website, as well as I have a blog link on my blog, and you know, getting the contact information is very easy for both of us. So,
yeah, Google. Yep. Google always works. Okay, well, have a good trip up to Alaska, and
yeah, you too.
I don't know if we'll have a chance to talk before I head out, but if we don't, then I guess maybe we'll reconvene in July.
Yeah, it sounds like, well, if you're going to be coming back in July, then I'll be back up in Alaska again for a couple of weeks. So point this summer. I kind of go back and forth every couple of weeks, and then come home with my family for a few weeks. So.
Right. Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing how your trips went.
Excellent. Well, I know you're going to have a good trip too. So.
Definitely. Okay. Thanks, John.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Tony.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Bye-bye.